We listen to Ronnie. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers. Ronnie remembers.
This is Ronnie Allen, and I spent a few hours trying to come up with an appropriate number to open up this show. Did I succeed? Why, of course.
A cough.
Gesundheit. Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, played and laughed and sneezed by Spike Jones and his aggregation. Sometimes called the Jones Laughing Record, and I hear that Mickey Katz is somewhere in there. And by the way, the man playing the trombone on that unusual recording was the extremely talented and frequently interrupted musician Tommy Peterson. And you can find it on a CD called Spike Jones is Murdering the Classics. Many people feel that Spike Jones raised the bar when it comes to a band leader satirizing popular, classical, operatic, and virtually all other types of music. I respectfully disagree. I contend Spike Jones did not raise the bar. Spike Jones created the bar, and he placed it so high that no other band leader has ever matched him. I have been unabashedly a huge Spike Jones admirer for all of my 39 years of my life. And in this show, I will be living a dream, interviewing the son of the legend. It is my pleasure and honor to welcome to the show... Spike Jones, Jr.
Thank you, Ronnie. It's nice to be here.
Before we get to this tribute to your legendary dad, I want to talk a little bit about your own career. Is it accurate to say, Spike, that your career has been more or less, for the most part, behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think that's very accurate. I produce award shows and reality programs, red carpet shows, live events. I've been doing it for 20-plus years. It's nice to not have the pressure to be out in front of people and, you know, I can sneak behind the camera and I prefer that.
You're also a public speaker. You are
right.
Every so often you do get out there. You're a moderator and a panel participant for industry events, particularly entertainment industry events. And you're a founder of an organization called SJ2 Entertainment.
Correct.
And briefly, we're going to mention this at the end of the show, you were in front of the camera, starting when your dad was ill, and then for a couple of years after he passed away, you were actually leading his band.
Yeah, it wasn't terrific under the circumstances, but it sure was a great deal of fun putting my dad's illness aside. It was great to be able to play the cowbells and shoot off the guns and honk the horns and all of that other stuff. I was like 15 years old, so still very much a child, and it was just terrific to do it.
I want to let people know that Wikipedia is not always accurate, but you told me that the Wikipedia article on Spike Jones Jr. is accurate.
Correct.
Therefore, anything that we didn't cover here about your career, people who want to learn a little bit more about you can visit the Wikipedia article on you. And before we start doing the tribute to your dad, you had a recording out that I used to remember Dr. Demento played on his show. He played it, I think, at least 30 times, and the name of the record was A Song with Appeal. Now, I remember around the time you did that record, Donovan had a hit record called Mellow Yellow, and he was talking about an electrical banana. And A Song with Appeal is about bananas, written by the Edrisi brothers, Don and Dick Edrisi. What can you tell us about your recording of A Song with Appeal, P-E-E-L?
Well, you're right. It was at the time when a certain group of people were saying that if you took a banana peel, stuck it in the oven, and dried it for I forgot how long. The particles inside the peel would get toasty and warm, and then you'd take it out of the oven, and you would crumple those up and roll them into a cigarette, you know, like a joint or whatever, very similar. And if you lit it and smoked it, it would get you high. That was a vicious rumor, right? I mean, we tried it and had no idea how they, number one, you did it, and the particles, it was like shard glass, you know, because it was crispy and stuff, and it would pop holes through the paper. It would just totally fall apart, and you could never get to it. But the Idrisi brothers got together, and they called, and they said, why don't we do a comedy version of it? And we did it, put it out, and it got some noise.
Yeah, it got released on the Viva label, if I recall.
Correct.
And, by the way, the Idrisi brothers, they had their own minor hit in the late 50s called Cherry Stone, but they went on to write a song that was a huge hit for the association called Never My Love. Right now, here is Spike Jonze Jr. and A Song with Appeal.
Have you ever wondered why a monkey acts as if he's high? The things he does the craziest can be.
Oh yeah, well that funky little monkey, that little jungle junk eats bananas and goes drinking through the trees. Have you ever sung along to a banana picker song? Mr. Tallyman, tally me banana. He can't wait to pick 'em, get home to roll and lick 'em. A million picker puppers can't be wrong. We want a pack of ripe bananas, 20 class A bananas, regular menthol filter will do. There isn't nothing takes a loving like something from the oven, 'cause how could they bust you for smoking a piece of fruit?
Long time since I've heard it, and I sort of know why now.
Okay. I'm Ronnie Allen, so pleased to be talking to Spike Jonze Jr., and during this show, we're not going to play complete recordings. We're going to play edits. We're going to play fade-outs, because we want to get a lot of Spike Jonze music in. Right now, we're going to start the official tribute to your dad, Lindley Armstrong Jonze. Can you tell us how he got the name Spike?
The legend goes, which was true, his father worked for a railroad, the Southern Pacific Railroads. My dad was born around the Long Beach, California area. And he would walk home via the railroad tracks. And because of that, and because of his personality and just his whole fun attitude, he was named Spike. Just like that, due to the association with the railroads and so on and so forth.
And one of the things that he did during his early career, well, he played the drums, for one thing.
Yes, very well. He was a major studio musician.
According to what I read, a railroad restaurant chef taught him how to use not just drums, but pots and pans, forks, knives, and spoons as musical instruments.
Yeah, it was because they didn't have a drum set he could access easily, so the chef set it up, utilizing pots and pans, and the rest is history.
And in fact, one of the interesting things is that Spike got into doing what he did because he was bored with music that was out there that was popular, but he found a lot of it kind of bland.
Yeah, I mean, he was a studio musician doing very well. He played on record dates, he played on radio shows, and he was having a good time, but he also had a unique sense of humor and found that if he took a couple of songs that he appreciated or whatever and then started doing some funny versions of it, that it might get some reaction and stuff. So he got some of the guys that he used to play with on a regular basis. And they rehearsed a couple of times. In fact, they rehearsed at a cemetery here in Hollywood.
Really?
Yeah, it was the only place that they could find that had enough room at the time where you could set up a band. And also, nobody in a cemetery is going to bother you. They weren't going to bother anybody there. So that's where they worked out of a lot and got the band together and then started recording. And
that's where it started.
And exactly.
From 1937 to 1942, he played percussion for the John Scott Trotter Orchestra. They, in fact, played on Bing Crosby's first recording of White Christmas. By the time he started getting really noted, he had quite a bit of experience, obviously. Many sources report that his first recording that actually got noise was Der Fuhrer's Face. But prior to that, on the record chart, believe it or not, there was another recording that came out before that. Reportedly, it featured Del Porter and Mel Blanc. The song is called Clink Clink Another Drink. Can you tell us anything about that song?
Well, he went into the studio, and he tells a very funny story. When the band was going around to different labels to get signed or whatever, he said he had never heard or seen any excitement before or since. Decca Records wanted Columbia to have them, and Columbia wanted RCA to have them, and RCA finally signed them just to get them out of the studio and out of the offices. Then they did four records, one of which was Clink Clink, and it did feature Mel Blanc, who was doing voices at the time. And my dad would always reach outside beyond the point of having the guys in the band, if somebody special, whether it was Mel Blanc or Paul Frees or whatever, he would bring them into the session, and they would have a good time.
It's gone.
Drink, drink, the glasses clink,
making tinkly music till the dawn is breaking.
Clang, clang, who cares a dang?
What's the difference when you're on a spree? Over the teeth, behind the gums, look out, stomach, here she comes.
I have another drink on me. Gurgle, 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 gurgle. Gurgle, 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 gurgle. Trickle, 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 slice of cheese and bite of pickle, doesn't even cost a nickel now to wash it down. Whoa!
Clink, clink, no more to drink. I had a cellar full, but now it's gone. Drink, drink, the glasses clink, like the anvil chorus, and my head is splitting. A breaky, a busty, oh, brother, oh, ow, what do I do now? Pink elephants are running after me. Though that stuff was smooth as silk, from now on I'll stick to milk. Nothing else to drink for me.
Clink, clink, another drink. I am Ronnie Allen talking to, I was going to say, talking to Mel Blanc. Boy, it shows you where I am. It's a good thing this is not a live show. I could edit all my mistakes out. But this is Ronnie Allen talking to Spike Jonze Jr. The next record that came out got even more attention. In fact, it got to number 3 on the chart. And it was called Der Fuhrer's Face. When that came out, was that considered a controversial record at that time?
It came out as a Disney cartoon first. It was called Donald Duck and Nazi Land. Obviously, a takeoff on Nazi Land. And then my dad took the song from that cartoon and recorded it in the studio. And it was very controversial because it was like one of the first things against a worldwide leader. It wasn't too terrific for Hitler. And also, they used a thing in it called the raspberry, which was
yeah,
one of those.
That was good. You did that very well.
That's my heritage, you know?
Yeah, it must be.
Right. That, too, was controversial at the time, but the record came out, and it was a huge, huge hit.
When the Führer says, "Wie ist der Master Ace?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, "Wie own the world in space?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Goebbels' face. When Herr Göring says, "He'll never bomb this place." "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan Führer Superman?
Yeah, we are Sir Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. Heil Hitler's world new order.
Everyone of foreign race,
we love the Führer's face. When we bring to the world disorder, when the Führer says, "He is the master race." "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face. Not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So "Wie heil, heil!"
Right in the Führer's face.
The Führer's face, that record featured Carl Grayson and Willie Spicer. Was Carl Grayson a musician or just a vocalist?
A vocalist and a musician. Yeah, he played violin / fiddle.
One of the things that really gets me, and we'll be talking about this throughout the show, is the cast of characters. He had such a diverse group of people, and they were not just musicians, but many of them were vocalists, and they were comedians as well. It's just amazing how he put them together. Were they the City Slickers back when they did the Führer's face?
No, he had not yet come up with the name. That just developed over time when he started going on the road and they started traveling. And they played a lot of local gigs here in Southern California and stuff. But only when he started going on the road and traveling more and doing things to push the record, so to speak, he came up with the name of the City Slickers.
By the way, the Führer's face, which, as I mentioned, got to number 3 on the record chart, was actually Spike's second highest charted record. But in a moment, we're going to get to a record that was only his third highest charted record, but is probably better known than any other record that Spike Jonze ever made. But before we get to it, I'm going to play a little bit of one that came out around that time that only got to number 20. But I love saying the title of this one, so it is, let's see, "Oh By G, By Gosh, By Gum, By Jill."
In the land of San Domingo, there's a girl called Oh By Jingo. From the fields and from the marshes came the young and oh by goshes. Spoke with a different lingo, but they all loved Oh By Jingo. And every night they sang in the pale moonlight, "Oh By G, By Gosh, By Gum, By Jub. Oh By Jingo, won't you hear our love? We will build for you a hut. You will be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little bow, by gollies, and we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By jiminy, please don't bother me. So the old went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jump, by jingo. By gee, you're the only girl for me.
Well, are you familiar with that one, Spike?
I'm familiar as an audience member, and knowing it, it was a great deal of fun, and your information is amazing. The fact that it got up to number 20.
Yeah.
It's an obscure Spike Jones record, but the fact that it got up that high is very surprising.
One of the things I want to do in this show is have a mix of the better-known records, some of them exceptionally well-known, and a few that people may not have ever heard. So that's one that is falling into that category, I suppose. Now we're going to get to a single. One side of this next single was Leave the Dishes in the Sink, Ma, written by Uncle Milty. That is comedian Milton Berle.
Yeah, it was.
Del Porter is featured on this one. Did Milton Berle write the song for Spike to do?
He wrote it, and I think my dad heard it and liked it and decided to record it, which is basically how they did it in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And Milton always said he was very lucky because for that song to be on the B-side of Cocktails for Two put him in a terrific position.
Well, as a songwriter, if you're on the B-side of a record, you get paid just as much as being on the A-side for records sold, right?
Sure, exactly.
Mechanicals. Let's listen to a little bit of this one, which got to number 14, believe it or not. Leave the Dishes in the Sink, Ma.
Pa started in a runnin' when he heard the whistle blow. The postman brought a letter, an airmail from our Joe. It said, I've come back safely from across the ocean blue. Then Pa took off Pa's apron and he hollered out, Yahoo!
Leave the dishes in the sink. Pa, leave the dishes in the sink.
Each dirty plate will have to wait. Tonight we're gonna celebrate.
Leave the dishes in the sink.
Pa started in a jiggin' and he cried, Pa, shake a leg. I'm going down the cellar cause there's cider in the keg. The bologna's in the icebox. There's cheese and pickles too. We'll call in all the neighbors cause tonight's our night. Yahoo!
Leave the dishes in the sink. Pa, leave the dishes in the sink.
Each dirty plate will have to wait. Tonight we're gonna celebrate.
Leave the dishes in the sink.
Leave the dishes in the sink, Ma. And not too shabby to get to number 14, but it was the flip side of that record that became probably, arguably, the best known Spike Jones recording ever. Got to number 4 on the chart, but that doesn't really tell the whole story. How did Spike get to do Cocktails for Two?
This was being done during the record ban. There was a record ban going on in the early 40s because of the Musicians Union. But what a lot of the bands were able to do, and singers and so on and so forth, they were able to record what were called standard transcriptions. These were recordings that were not under the guise of the AFFM, mm-hmm. and they were able to be released just as a normal record would be, but it didn't infringe on, you know, the AFFM or its contract or its negotiations or anything. And my dad was in Europe at the time performing for the troupe with the band, and he came back from Europe, and a DJ, I believe it was Martin Block out of New York, he talked to him and he said, why didn't you tell us about Cocktails for Two? Well, it's a smash hit over here in the States, and my dad had no idea of it. But when he got back, the record ban was over with, and they went into the studio, re-recorded it, and that was released by RCA.
This record features Carl Grayson, and Mickey Katz is in there. And before I play it, I want to let you know that the songwriter, Sam Coslow, reportedly did not like this irreverent treatment at all. He hated this. But he did laugh all the way to the bank, I understand.
I'll tell you something. I'm having coffee with Sam Coslow's daughter next week. She and I have never met, but we've been friends on Facebook. And so I just sort of raised my hand and said, why don't we get together and say hello? And I believe we're both around the same age. And sort of feel like it's the Hatfields and the McCoys meeting.
Well,
you know, it'll be very interesting.
It should be interesting, but keep in mind that a lot of what's on the internet may not not be true. Maybe privately Sam loved the record. I don't know.
Yeah, you never know.
But you could find out next week. Anyway, here's that legendary Spike Jones recording, and I'm going to play this one in its entirety, Cocktails for Two.
Charming scene like this in some secluded rendezvous that overlooks the avenue with someone sharing a delight. Chat, sip some bad and cocktails for two as we enjoy a cigarette to some exquisite chansonette. Two hands are sure to slyly meet beneath a serviette with cocktails for two. My head may go reeling, but my heart will be obedient with intoxicating kisses for the principal ingredients. Most any afternoon at 5, we'll be so glad we're both alive. Then maybe fortune will complete the plan that all began with cocktails for two. Glad we're both alive.
We're both glad we're alive.
Then maybe fortune will complete
her plan that all began with Cocktails for Two.
Cocktails for Two, Spike Jones and his City Slickers. This came out in 1945, and he was using the name City Slickers by then.
Yes, he was.
Next one that I have on my list here is Chloe, C-H-L-O-E. I believe it was Red Ingle featured on this recording.
Yeah, it was.
Red Ingle is best known for Cigarettes and Whiskey and Wild Wild Women on his own. And this one got to number 5.
Chloe, Chloe, someone's calling.
Hello? You don't say. You don't say. You don't say.
Who was it?
He didn't say.
No reply. Nightshade's fallen. Hear him sigh. Chloe.
Where are you, you old bat?
Empty spaces and meaty eyes. Empty arms outstretched.
He's crying
through the black of night. I got to go where you are.
Whether it's here or whether it's there, I want to be there wherever you are.
If it's I got it all when you
are. Hello, Chloe. What are you knowing?
I just got back from a bottle showing.
I roam through the dismal swampland, searching for you. Cause if you are lost there, let me be that.
Three, four, one.
Hands through that smoke and flame. I've got to go where you are.
Thunder, lightning, shower, snow. When I get a call, I gotta go.
For no place can be too far where you are. Age and no chains can bind you. And if you live, I'll find you. Love is calling me. I got to go where you are. Age and all chains can bind you. And if you do, I'm going to find you, my pretty baby. Love is calling me.
Hello? You don't say. You don't say.
Who was it?
Same guy.
I've got to go where you are.
That was Chloe, Spike Jones, and his City Slickers. And now we have an instrumental called Holiday Four Strings. But just between you and me, I think Spike should have called it Ha, 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 the Day Four Strings. When you took over the band, was that one of the songs that the band did?
Yeah, my dad had set up as part of a medley that he would do that would include Holiday for Strings, Chloe, and Cocktails for Two. It was written by a great composer by the name of David Rose, who ultimately my dad and David became very close friends, and it was also the theme from the Red Skelton Show.
You know what David Rose is best known for?
The stripper.
That's right. I'm Ronnie Allen talking with Spike Jones Jr., and so pleased to be doing this, and we are moving right along now to one of my favorite Spike Jones recordings. This is with the Wacky Waikikians, the backing group on Hawaiian War Chant.
Yeah.
The Wacky Waikikians. Any comment on Hawaiian War Chant?
If you listen to it, you hear how layered it is, and it just kicks. You know, the band is great, the glugs are great, the sounds are very Hawaiian, yet specific to Spike Jonze. It's just a great, great song.
Well, it's Hawaiian, but it's kind of also a satire of Hawaiian as well. Now, this got to number 8 on the chart. This is Spike Jonze and his wacky Waikikians Hawaiian war chant, Tahua, Hua, Way, Why, whatever.
Sun pulls away from the shore, and our boat sinks slowly in the west. We approach the island of Lulu, spelled backwards.
Ul-ul.
Ah, in the distance we hear Spike Jonze and his wacky Waikikians.
War chant. We're in the year 1948 because we're doing this basically chronologically for the most part. I want to talk a little bit about a gentleman named Winstead Sheffield Glendening Dixon Weaver.
You have at it, Ronnie. Go right ahead.
He was well known by a different name, though.
Doodles.
Yes, easy to say Doodles Weaver. He had this character that he introduced called Professor Fiedelbaum, and what this character did was he spoke in spoonerisms. His shtick was mixing up words and sentences in various songs and recitations. He toured the country with a Spike Jonze Music Depreciation Review until 1951. And before I play a couple of the hit records that Doodles Weaver was associated with the Spike Jonze Orchestra, I'm going to play this record that gives you an example of all the spoonerisms we're talking about. This is Doodles Weaver's, I can't even say it, just thinking about him. Doodles Weaver's rendition of The Man on the Flying Trapeze.
As the crowd roars to the center ring steps our fractured baritone. Are you in voice, Winstead?
I believe I am in voice. Professor?
Ooh.
Oh, Hans,
I was wappy, once I was sappy, a sap I was once, no, no. Once I was happy, but wow, I'm forlorn, lorn, I'm found now, a fly on line, nylons are free, no, no. Now I'm forlorn, like an old goat, oh no, not a goat, that's an animal, like an old coat that is tornered and fat, teetered and tumped, tattered and tipped, tap with a toupee, ripped. Left in this wide world to sleep and to snore, to weep and to mourn. Betrayed by a jade in her mean, no. Be mean by a trade for some jeans, no. Be jean by a teen with some jade, no. Betrayed by a maid in her teens, oh. He floats by his hair, oh, not by his hair, that would hurt. Speaking of hair, a man came up to me today and said, Doodles, your hair is getting thin. And I said, well, who wants fat hair? Headache killer! He floats through the air with the eightest of grease, with the latest of fleas, with plates full of cheese, no, no, with the birds and the bees, he can't miss. The manning young dare, the daring young mare, he's not a horse, that's silly, he'd break his neck. The fanning young dan, the danning young fat, he's an awful old ham, he's a young fellow about my age. You know, a funny thing happened, a man came out to me and said, Doodles, Doodles, did you leave home? I said, I left home. He said, did you put the cat out? I said, I didn't know he was on fire. Oh, the killer! The daring young man on the flapping tripeze, a treasing triflaps, a trying flip-flip, a flipping tri-bump, a fapping tri-bell, horizontal bars.
Doodles Weaver, Man on the Flying Trapeze. Where he really became famous was when he, along with the Spike Jones Orchestra, this record got to number 6 on the chart. Somebody named Rossini wrote something called the William Tell Overture. Most right. People probably think it's just the Lone Ranger theme. Well, anybody could make that mistake. Anyway, speaking of mistakes, we go to Doodles Weaver right now. This is the Spike Jones recording of the William Tell Overture, and it speaks for itself. And they're at the starting gate right now.
It's a beautiful day for the race. Stooge Hand is the favorite today. Assault is in there. Dog Biscuit is 3-1. Safety Pin has been scratched. And at 20-1, Beetlebum. Now the horses are approaching the starting gate, and there they go! And it's Stooge Hand going to the front. Cabbage is second on the rail. Beautiful Linda is third by a length. And Beetlebum. Around the first turn, Stooge Hand is still in front. Cabbage is second by a head.
Cabbage by a head!
Beautiful Linda is third. And Beetlebum. Into the back spits. Dog Biscuit is now leading the pack. Lady Evelyn is second, very close. Banana is coming up through the bunch.
Banana! Coming up through the bunch!
And Beetlebum. At the half, Stooge Hand still out in front. Apartment House is second with plenty of room. Assault is passing battery.
Assault battery!
Notary Sojack is fourth. And in last place by 10 lengths, I believe it is. Yes, it is Beetlebum. Around a turn, heading for home. It's Stooge Hand and Dog Biscuit and Girdle in the stretch. Flying Sylvester is third. And Mother-in-Law nagging in the rear. And now they come down to the wire, and it's number one, and now number two, and it's very close. It'll either be a photo finish or an oil painting. And now Lewis leads with the left, and Lewis is in there slugging, and it's a battle, and now they're tearing hair. There's hair all over the ring, there's hair all over the place. I don't know whose hair it is. It's mine. And there goes the winner!
Spike Jones and his City Slickers, and slickest of all on that record, Doodles Weaver. And Spike did a very similar recording to that a year later with Doodles. Dance of the Hours, this is a takeoff on the Indy 500. Thank you.
afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Doodles Weaver in the press box at Indianapolis for the races out here. It's a beautiful day for the races. Not a cloud in the sky. 150,000 people are waiting for this great event. What a spectacle. What a wonderful spectacle. I'll describe the whole thing now. The boys are coming around the turn. I believe it's a perfect shot as they come down here. The green flag waves. The starter says, okay. And there they go! It's car number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Jack. Jack, hit me again, dealer. No. Number 10 is taking a lead around the far turn. He goes number 13, 16, 17, a green car, blue car. The first car by the stands will be number 10. Here he comes down the straightaway, 135 miles an hour. There he goes now. Car number 3, 4, 9. A wreck! A wreck in the far turn. A man skidding around, out of control, up to the fence, down to the fence. But he's careful, he's getting hit the fence. Please don't hit that fence. He hit it. Ladies and gentlemen, there's been a very slight accident in the far turn involving 35 cars. I have my assistant Pootwaddle on the track with a traveling microphone. I'm going to have him cross where the driver is. Take it away, but be careful.
I'm down the track now, and as I cross the track, number 3 went by there. As I cross the track, 4 went by there. Well, I'm having a little trouble getting across the track. Here's the driver of that car. Say a few words, driver, so everybody will know you're perfectly okay. You just turned the driver of that car. He's all right.
And the best man is number 13 around the turn down to the green flag. He's coming down here for that 10. If you think of the perfect finish down here, I believe he's going to be the winner. The crowd is going mad as he comes down, and there goes the winner!
Before I continue our discussion, and by the way, Doodles Weaver, sadly he passed away under, I think, pretty tragic circumstances, but he certainly made a name for himself with the Spike Jones Orchestra, and his records over the years have been... What was that?
That was my phone ringing.
Oh, okay. I thought it was something that I said. Doodles made quite a reputation over the years, of course. Obviously, Spike Jones was not the only music satirist. I want to acknowledge a few others who did satire. One of them was Stan Freberg.
He became popular in the 50s.
Did Spike and Stan know each other?
Yeah, they did. In fact, Stan Freberg told me once about a conversation that he had with my dad in the parking lot of a market here in Los Angeles. I was a huge Stan Freberg fan, as so many other people were.
Me too.
He was just a brilliant, brilliant writer. The two both did satire, but totally different. My dad had a band, and Stan was... you know, an individual who would cast his records and stuff like that from great actors and use Billy May and his orchestra. You know, it was more conceptual because all my dad's stuff came from the fact that it was a band and they didn't know any better.
Right. But having said that, I do want to point out that your dad and Stan did do some similar things, namely takeoffs on pop records. Now, Stan Freberg did a takeoff on Heartbreak Hotel, The Great Pretender, The Rock Island Line, and of course, speaking of bananas, the Banana Boat song, Stan Freberg did that great one, I Come Through the Window. Remember the end of that?
Yeah,
record?
I just love that.
Well, your dad did a few, and we're going to play several of those that were takeoffs on pop recordings. Other satirists were Homer and Jethro. Actually, Spike worked with Homer and Jethro on at least one record called Pagliacci.
Yeah.
Homer and Jethro were a duo, popular on the country music scene primarily. They did pretty much song parodies. Actually, your dad did a couple of versions of Pagliacci, but we're going to play this one featuring Homer and Jethro, and it really sounds like a Homer and Jethro record.
Was in the city, we was wondering where to go. A sign spelled out Pagliacci up in lights above the show. We thought it would be a western till the stage lit up with light. And 97 people sung without a horse in sight. We couldn't understand them cause they spoke a foreign tongue. But we can give you some idea of what we think they sung. At once, there's a fat guy in a clown suit. 'Tain't Halloween, that's for sure.
Then this here feller, this punchy neller, begins to feller like we all was deep. That was how Yankee and he sung. Invest in a tuba and something or other about Cuba. He sung about a lady who weighs 280. When she takes a powder, he just starts chirping louder. And he don't do a doggone thing except to stand up there and sing. When we listen to Payachi, we get itchy and scratchy. This sure is top corn, so we go and buy some popcorn. We hate to go back, but we can't get our dough back. Ain't no use complaining, cause outside it's a-raining. Later, we're still in the darn theater, taking turns and napping, wait for something to happen. Payachi, he ain't hurrying, but the folks on stage are flurrying, and it sounds like Ketchy Turian's neighbor dance. Then old Payachi finds a guy he's seeking, cheek to cheek, and with his wife, he grabs a knife and stabs a louse who stole his spouse, and then he stabs a lady and himself. Tain't very sanitary. They all collapse, but old Payachi sets up, then he gets up, sings, I'm dying, I am dying, I am dying. We start crying, cause to tell the truth, we're dying too. As the footlights fade out, we see Payachi laid out, but the dagger never calls it. Payachi was plumb exhausted.
Yachi, that was Homer and Jethro, along with the Spike Jones and the City Slicker Orchestra. Well, we talked about the best-known Spike Jones record, arguably being Cocktails for Two, but in terms of performance on the record chart, this was the only one that actually got to number one. And this one is All I Want for Christmas is My Two Front Teeth, featuring a little kid named George Rock, who was not really a little kid. What can you tell me about George Rock?
Brilliant trumpet player, nicest man in the world. His playing was really responsible, I think, for the great Spike Jones sound. Such a happy band and such great music. He was just absolutely brilliant. He did great vocals. In Two Front Teeth, one of the strange things, my dad went in the studio with the band to record that, plus a couple of other things, and at the very end of the session, they were running out of time, so they said, okay, let's try Two Front Teeth. And George had a bit where he would spray with his, you know, his mouth and stuff like that. And they tried Two Front Teeth like that, and it just didn't work. So then George said, well, why don't we try this? And he came up with the whistling, and that became the record, and they had like 15 minutes left in the session. They recorded it, and it was a huge hit.
"'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, had a creaturely spirit, not evil to harms. Suddenly I heard a strange noise down below, so in my flannel pajamas, I went tippy-toe. I could see your safety from the spot where I stood, so I slid down the banister just as fast as I could. All I want for Christmas is my two front teeth, my two front teeth, see my two front teeth. Gee, if I could only have my two front teeth, then I could wish you Merry Christmas. It seems so long since
Not only was that a huge hit, but it became a Christmas classic every year around Christmas time. Another 15 minutes more of fame for that particular recording, All I Want for Christmas. And George Rock did a couple of other similar recordings. I'm going to play a little bit of this one, which got to number 24 on the chart. And I guess this came around Easter time, I would assume, because the title is You Want to Buy a Bunny? George Rock, You Want to Buy a Bunny? That was 1949. Well, I've been looking for a record to play at this time, which actually features Spike Jones, your dad, doing a great, funny narration. And I found something. This is called Knighthood Goes to Pot. And we go back to the days of King Arthur's court. And Spike Jones is doing most of the narration on this one.
The framework for the song, my dad used it many different times. In fact, was also the framework for Wyatt Earp Makes Me Burp.
If not the same tune, it might have been the same idea. He did a few records that were along the same lines at that time. And this was one of them. This recording is from a live radio show.
Arthur's court, but how I got there was a great mystery. I made a journey to King Arthur's court and turned back the pages of history.
Well, here I am in the 5th century. I wonder what adventure's in store for me. Here comes a knight in armor. He's not so dumb. He's using his visor to pop his bubble gum. That sure is a snappy suit of armor you've got.
I'm the sharpest dresser in Camelot.
Who makes your suits, my modest man?
Hart, Schaffner, and American Cam.
Why are you so fidgety, oh noble knight?
I sent my armor to the laundry last night and come back without buttons, and it made me frown.
Don't look now, but your drawbridge is down.
Who art thou? Speak up, I warn you.
I'm a Connecticut Yankee from California.
California, where it always rains?
Not anymore. There's been a big change. Did you hear about the christening and why it was done?
No.
California finally had a little son.
I'm Sir Lancelot. You're a dirty spy. You're my prisoner and you're gonna die. You were sent by Crosby. I could tell by your hair.
I didn't come to praise Bing. I came to Barry Fitzgerald.
I'm sorry, Yankee. It's either your head or we'll feed you to the dragon instead.
Well, before that happens, for you, I've got news. I'll blow out my brains. I got nothing to lose.
Now we find the Yankee and Sir Lancelot approaching the drawbridge to Camelot.
This drawbridge looks kind of weak to me. Do you think it'll hold us?
Yay, verily. Why, I carried my wife across safe and sound. My dear little wife weighs 500 pounds.
500 pounds? I can't believe your lips. How did you do it?
I made 2 trips.
Well, to me, that drawbridge looks pretty beat. Let's jump across. It's only 6 feet.
But this suit of armor is heavy as can be.
Don't let it worry you. Just watch me. Here I go. Okay, it's your turn. Be careful. Don't fall.
Here I come, suit of armor and all.
Things look sad for the Connecticut Yankee. We'd shed a few tears if we had a hanky. We find him in the dungeon, his hopes are sagging. He's about to be fed to the ferocious dragon.
Don't feed me to that dragon or I'll scream and shout. I can't stand that fire shooting out of his mouth.
That fire shooting out is the way he greets you.
Well, at least he cooks you before he eats you.
Now, I want you to know that this dragon of mine will obey my commands at any time. Just listen to him snort when I give him an order. Snort.
He's a pretty short snorter.
Before he eats you, have you anything to say?
Is this the last dragon in the world today?
Yes, it is. All the rest have all died out.
Then there's something I'd like to ask you about. Do I get a last supper before I die?
Anything you wish.
I'll have a dragon on rye.
Knighthood goes to pot. Spike Jones and his silly slickers. Well, that would fit too, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
City Slickers is what the correct title is. I mentioned that there was a similarity between your dad and what Stan Freberg did in terms of doing satires of big hit recordings. And right now we're going to play excerpts from 5 of those Spike satires. If you want, you can call them Spike Tires. And all 5 of the records that are being made fun of made number 1 on the chart. First one is Ghost Riders in the Sky. And this one became a huge hit on the pop chart for somebody named Vaughn Monroe. Anything you could recall about this record?
There were a couple of Vaughn Monroe jokes in it. And Vaughn Monroe owned a great deal of RCA stock at the time. In fact, he was on the board of directors. And he created such pressure that RCA went to my dad and they had to go back in the studio and change some of the lyrics to get rid of the Vaughn Monroe references.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that Vaughn wasn't laughing at them?
Not at all. Oh. The man apparently had no sense of humor whatsoever.
There's no way I can get a copy of the uncensored original version of this, is there?
I don't know. I can check with the guys who have the library, and I can find out.
I would have thought that Vaughn would have been thrilled. More promotion for him.
No, he didn't need the promotion. He had a lot of money at the time.
Well, I got a big surprise for you, Spike. I just found this out as I'm editing this show. In the version that I'm about to play, they did not remove all the Vaughn Monroe jokes, because there is one of them at the end.
Cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way.
When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw,
a plowing through the ragged skies in a cloudy draw. And a tour. Jesse. When do I come in, old timer?
In this song, it don't matter, partner. Go ahead, sing.
Their faces got, their eyes were blurred, their shirts all wet with sweat.
Don't be half sad, foolish boy.
They're riding hard to catch the herd, but they ain't caught her yet.
Get along, little doggy, 'cause you got to ride forever on that age up in the sky.
On horses snorting fire.
Is that possible?
How would I know? As they ride on, hear their cry.
This is a cowboy legend.
Well, in the year 1950, actually, this one I think came out probably 1949, going into 1950, Frankie Lane had a huge hit with something called Mule Train, and of course, Spike Jonze had to do his own inimitable rendition. Now, it says on the label that this one features Fleddy, F-L-E-D-D-Y, Morgan. It's actually Freddie Morgan.
Freddie Morgan was one of the greatest comic musicians that there ever was. He played banjo, banjo with my dad's band, and guitar, and he was just brilliant.
This is Freddie, or Fleddy, whatever you want to call him.
Not very PC, you know?
Yeah. Got to number 16 on the chart in 1950. This is Chinese Mule Train.
Clippity clap, clippity clap, clippity 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 clap and along. Oh now, no good, no more now, no good, I am now. Pull them out, oh now, 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 oh Mario Mule, holy semi go clippity clap for Frankie Lane. Holy semi go clippity clap, clap, chop, chop for Blink Crosby. Holy semi go chop, chop, chop for Von Monroe. Holy semi go for Guy Lombardo. You fool, you mule, you fool. Hold on, hold on. There's a plug of short tobacco for a miner in Kelowna. A guitar for a cowboy way out in Arizona. A glass of calico for a plate in Navajo. Get a lahole, mule! Get a lahole, luchi! Hola! Clap and overheel and flame. Sing da
stars, how they never stop. Lippity-clop, got little telescopes and keychain for picture, knock your eye out. A Korean buffalo, who's going to have a tryout? A week from Sunday night, with Mr. Holy Tight, get the low horse. Oh, the flogging throw. He better take snow more for China. Lucia, you, Flaggy Lane, Bleak Sloggy, Von Monroe, Tennessee Ernie, oh, Lucia, hola, una, hola, hola, hola.
We don't worry too much about political correctness on Ronnie Allen shows. We just have fun.
That's it.
You could tell, Spike, that I'm having a lot of fun.
I'm glad. I am. I know.
Oh,
that.
Okay. I appreciate it. I'm glad you said that. Speaking of political correctness or incorrectness, this next one apparently was very controversial when it came out. There were a lot of Jewish groups that did not like this. Not so much that they didn't like the song. The song was a huge hit on the pop chart. Number one hit for Patti Page called Tennessee Waltz. There's a lady who was named Sarah Berner, and her specialty was doing dialects. And in this particular case, she's doing a Yiddish dialect. Well, what could you tell me about this rendition of Tennessee Waltz, which she did, by the way, with Sir Frederick Gass, who we're going to talk about in a moment.
It was just a great record, and as you said, it was very controversial because of the Jewish dialect. Pretty right on as far as a comedy record is concerned, and the audience loved it. I am Ronnie Allen talking to Spike Jones Jr. This is kind of this is your dad's life. That's what this show is. We're going through the highlights. Of course, if I had enough time to do this, this would be like a four-part miniseries because there are just so many recordings that we're not going to play today, and I could play like longer versions. But I want to point out, a lot of these recordings are still available. Amazon, right? A lot of the Spike Jones CDs? Yeah, they have quite a few original compilations that Sony RCA put out. There's a lot of duplication out there, but for the most part, many of the CDs have just a whole bunch of great stuff on it.
Fantastic. And also, there's a lot of Spike Jones videos on YouTube. Some of them are just audios of some of the hit songs, but there are some videos, and I want to point out that there was a 1988 documentary which you, Spike, participated in. You made some comments. The Spike Jones Story.
That was exactly the title of the
Spike Jones. Oh, I'm glad I got that right. Okay. Most of my audience are probably aware, if you've seen pictures of Spike, He wore these suits. What do you call them? Checked suits? They have like squares on them. Green?
Yeah, windowpane check suits.
Windowpane check suits. There is a scene in that 1988 documentary, Spike, where it's hard to believe. There's a scene. You're dressed in one of those suits.
Yeah. When I was like 3 years old, my dad had a suit made for me identical to his.
That was amazing.
It was great. He would work in Vegas, and oftentimes they would say, ladies and gentlemen, now it's Spike Jonze, and then I would walk out
in that
center,
suit.
Wow. The center mic, and people thought it was wonderful and terrific, and then my nanny would come and take me off stage, and my dad's show would start. So it was great fun. It was terrific.
Do you remember at the age of 3, did you feel uncomfortable when they tried to dress you in that suit?
I didn't know any better. If you look closely, I'm more embarrassed about the white shoes that I had to wear rather than the suit.
Getting back to the music, we have another Patti Page takeoff. Patti Page had a number one hit with I Went to Your Wedding, and this parody version features Sir Frederick Gass. Maybe I should just play this one for people who have never heard it before instead of describing what you're going to hear.
I went to your wedding, although I was dreading the thought of seeing you. Oh, that face. My poor heart was praying to hear the groom saying, I do, I do, I do. Oh, that poor fish.
I'm sorry.
You tripped down the aisle, fell flat on your... Smile, your father was lauded too.
What a mess.
He dragged your bouquet the rest of the way, and then and then he went back and dragged you.
To be continued in the next show, 100 years from now. And I don't know how it happened, but that got to number 20 on the chart. I don't know. You want to say anything more about that record, or do we just...
It stands alone.
Okay. And now, the last of our 5 consecutive hit record satires, The Glowworm. The Mills Brothers had the biggest hit version of this song with lyrics by Johnny Mercer, which was based on a classical piece. Let's hear a little bit of the Spike Jonze treatment of The Glowworm.
When the night falls silently, the night falls silently. On forest dreaming. Lovers wander for to see, they wander for to see, the bright stars gleaming. And lest they should lose their way, lest they should lose their way, the glowworms nightly light their tidy light. twinkle brightly. Here and there and everywhere through mossy dell and hollow.
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 Hollow, gal, hollow.
What do you say?
Floating, gliding through the air, they call on us to follow. Shine, little clover, glimmer. Shine, little clover, glimmer. Lead us lest too far we wander. Love's sweet voice is calling yonder. Shine, little clover, glimmer. Shine, little clover, glimmer. Light the path below.
You take it, girl.
Hey, get it.
And me.
That was the last of five consecutive, incredible Spike Jonze satires of number one hit records. Vaughn Monroe's Ghost Riders in the Sky, Frankie Lane's Mule Train, Patti Page's The Tennessee Waltz and I Went to Your Wedding, and the Mills Brothers, or is it Brothers Is, The Glowworm. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have something completely different. We're going to play a record that is not a Spike Jonze record. This is by a lady who Spike Jonze knew very well. Her name is Helen Greco.
Helen Greco is my mother. She joined the band around 48, somewhere in that neighborhood. My dad was going on the road with a two-hour, so to speak, circus called the Musical Depreciation Review, and he felt that his audience couldn't take 2 hours of straight humor. So he wanted to find a terrific singer to do 20 minutes, say, in the middle, so that the audience would have a chance to sit back, relax, and then the band would come back. And he and his manager went to the Palladium here in Los Angeles, saw my mother singing with Stan Kenton, really thought she was fabulous and terrific, and went backstage. And my mother at the time was a well-known singer, and she sort of got upset when he came back and he said, "We'd like you to join the band." And she said, "What are you, crazy? I'm a singer. Why would I want to join your band?" It was very well known at the time. And he explained it to her, and they went on the road for a while, and it was great. She had a good time, and he had a good time, and they ultimately fell in love and got married, and here I am, plus my other two sisters.
And your other two sisters are?
Leslie Ann Jonze and Gina Maria Jonze.
Leslie Ann, did she win a Grammy Award?
She's won 3 or 4 Grammy Awards. She's got a great ear. She heads up Skywalker Sound up in the Bay Area and has been there for quite a while. And she's just a great engineer and producer and so on and so forth.
Did your mom ever do comedy bits with the band?
No. In fact, it was important that there was a definite delineation between the two. She would just do the straight stuff, and he would do the funny stuff.
I'm going to play a little bit of a 1954 recording that your mom did. Got to number 24 on the chart. Oop Shoop.
With you, maybe right from the start, but if you ever decide to leave, you'll break my heart. Come on, baby, what makes you so sweet? Ooh, baby, you make my life complete. Come on, baby, I need your love tonight.
Shoo-be-doo-ah.
quite complete. Come on, baby, I need your love tonight. Ooh, shoo, ooh, bee, ooh, bee, ooh, bee. Ooh, shoo, ooh, bee, ooh, bee, ooh, bee. Ooh, shoo, ooh, bee, ooh, bee, ooh, bee.
Ooh, shoo, bee, ooh, bee, ooh, bee.
Was serious. Helen Greco doing a song with a very serious title called Oop Shoop. I mentioned Sir Frederick Gass. That was not the name that he was born with, of course. What was his real name?
His real name was Earl Bennett. Okay. And when my dad put the musical depreciation review together, the band toured a lot, like 50 weeks out of the entire year. What he would do was he would augment the players with great comedians and stunt people and so on and so forth. And Sir Frederick Gass, Earl Bennett, happened to be one of those individuals. He played the twig, which was absolutely brilliant and funny.
The twig?
You know, the twig. And he was a virtuoso at it. And his hair was at the time very bushy and long, way before long hair became fashionable. So my dad decided to change his name from Earl Bennett for stage to Sir Frederick Gass.
How come the name Sir Frederick Gass? Did he do some burping and belching sounds?
He did, but it was also just a very funny name. And here comes this gentleman. He was wearing a professor suit. It just fit his character really well.
And he was on a lot of legendary Spike Jones recordings. Before we get to Dr. Horatio Q. Birdbath, this inquiring mind would like to know, was your dad basically a very serious person, or was he always comedic? What can you tell us about him?
He was very serious about his work and the product, and it was very important. I think one of the reasons that he was so successful was because he did take it seriously, and the band sort of accumulated, you know, and it seemed like they just went out and played anything, but in actuality, it was very well rehearsed, very thought out. I always refer to the band very similar in nature to Lorne Michaels and the original cast of Saturday Night Live. If you look at all of that stuff, everything was memorized, and Lorne Michaels really hated it if the actors, no matter who they were or whatever, went off book, so to speak, and ad-libbed, because it was difficult to get back on track. And oftentimes it was funny at the moment to ad-lib, but it wouldn't last. My dad's feeling was the same way. Stick with it, because everything after that, you know, follows. It's essential that you stay on track. You know, when he's shooting up guns and stuff like that, he would go crazy if the blanks weren't put in properly and stuff like that, because if you think about it, it was all done live. So
oh, gosh.
There was no overdubbing. You couldn't go back and, you know, go in and overdub somebody else's part or whatever afterwards. It was all done at the same time.
There must have been a tremendous amount of rehearsals.
There were. And everybody had a great time doing it. In fact, I asked George Rock once, I said, what did you guys look for? And he said, if it made us laugh, then we kept it in the show.
I see. And when we're talking about shows, we're not just talking about live shows, we're also talking about TV shows, because he was on TV for how long? How many years were the Spike Jonze shows on TV?
At different times, I think it was about 6 years.
It amazed me because a lot of people can be great in the recording studio, but if you put them on TV, they're not going to be so great. Yet, it seems that all of these people were natural for TV. It amazed me.
Yeah, it was a very visual act, and it was important for him. You know, if he did a song that was different than what the record was, it was strictly because he wanted to go for something that would make a live audience laugh rather than just a record, so to speak. So oftentimes he would have to take something and change how it was done live so it would make a live audience laugh.
Yeah, I could just imagine if a gun didn't go off, what his expression might be.
Not terrific.
He can't just go bang, bang. Doesn't quite make it. Everybody that you heard, with the exception of course, Helen, but I'm talking about the members of the Spike Jonze, City Slickers, the comedic people on these records, just about all of them are gone. But there's one exception that you mentioned to me last week, is the drummer, Joe Siracusa.
Correct. Yeah, Joe is fortunately still with us. In fact, I see him periodically. We do things together. We just something a couple of weeks ago together, a panel was based on my dad, and Joe is terrific. He and his wife lived in Cleveland, and oftentimes when my dad would travel across the country, they would do so in two railroad cars. They would start in Los Angeles, go across the country, and travel in what was called SJ1 and SJ2. SJ1 was for the personnel, and SJ2 was for the props and the animals and everybody else. And he would hold auditions at train stations whenever he would get into a certain town, and his advance people would let people know. Joe was a very successful drummer at the time. He was also in the Army. And he only wanted to become part of the Spike Jonze Band. He didn't want to be a professional musician with anybody else. So he sent a card to my dad, and it was addressed to Spike Jonze, Paramount Studios, because my dad had done a movie there, Hollywood, California, and said, I'd love to meet you, talk to you, so on and so forth. And with that limited information, the card actually got to my father, which just baffles me. And my dad followed up with him, and they met, and Joe auditioned for the band, and he knew all the stuff backwards and forwards. He had listened to all the records and knew the tracks and stuff like that, and he was with my dad for 6 or 7 years and was just one of the great drummers for him, and decided to leave the band because he was tired of traveling.
What years was he with Spike?
I believe 48 through 53, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Your dad was also a drummer. Did your dad, when he was on stage most of the time, was he sitting behind the drums, or was he leading the band? Was he was both a band leader and a drummer?
Yeah, he was a drummer in the very beginning, and then he got another drummer to replace him, and slowly but surely he started to come around from the drums and work the front and took over as a traditional leader would. And the cowbells and everything else were percussion instruments, which is an extension of being a drummer. And so that's how we got, you know, the cowbells and the auto horns, percussion sounds, one on top of the other, in place of musical notes.
When your dad took sick, and it was around 63 or 64,
right,
in the 60s, at one point he was well enough to perform, but he was not well enough to perform 3 shows. He was only well enough to perform 2 shows, so you actually led the band for the 3rd show.
Yeah. In 1965, early in the year, he had an engagement playing in San Diego, and I was down with the band for that weekend because I was out of school or whatever, and anytime I had an opportunity to hang with them and see them in a club or whatever, whenever they would allow it, I was like 15 at the time, I would always do that. So, unfortunately, the last weekend he was there became ill with asthma and emphysema, and was forced that he go back to Los Angeles in an ambulance plane, and they were trying to figure out what to do with the weekend and the ticket sales and so on and so forth. And I just talked to the manager and said, look, I've seen this over and over and over again. Why don't we take a shot and put me in the band? You know, I was this little kid. I was like Justin Bieber without the tattoos.
You were able to do
okay.
It, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and they said, okay, why don't we try it? And the club owner said, sure, why don't we do it? So they reworked the show so that I did some of the stuff that my dad did and other people did other stuff. And it worked out well and came back to Los Angeles. And my dad had a couple of other engagements in Las Vegas and Lake Tahoe and Reno. It was in the days when the lounges were very big and they would do 3 shows a night into like 4 in the morning. And my dad wasn't able to do the last one, and it was easy for me to do it. So my dad would do the first 2 shows and I would do the 3rd one. And I remember one night we were at the Showboat Hotel performing, and he was sitting on the steps that came down under the stage when I was doing him, so to speak. And I saw this huge smile on his face, and it was just the greatest thing I had ever, to this day, had ever, you know, witnessed, and he really appreciated it, and it was great.
He passed away in May of 1965, and for a couple of years after, you continued to lead his band, is that correct?
Yeah, we continued. There were some engagements that were still left to fulfill, and people at Harris Club and both Reno and Lake Tahoe said, yeah, sure, do it. And I got to perform with the band, and it was Spike Jonze Jr. and the band that plays for fun. And my mother said, okay, fine, enough of this nonsense, back to school.
Linda November and Artie Schreck in 1997 in Atlantic City put together a review. It was called The New City Slickers Present a Tribute to Spike Jonze. Did you get to see that show?
Yeah, I did. In fact, Linda and Artie and I worked together on it a little bit, and they were great, and the players that they put together were fabulous and fun, and it was a great act.
You know what she's best known for, don't you?
Meow, 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 meow.
And about 22,000 other jingles.
Exactly. Right.
She is not just the jingle lady, she is the empress when it comes to jingles. Well, we got three more to go, including the one that you provided us with, which is going to close the show. But first, we got my two doggy ones. We got to a guy named Dr. Horatio Q. Birdbath. Real name was A. Purvis Pullins.
Pullin, yeah.
Or Pullin. Pullin or Pullins, I don't know.
Pullin. P-U-L-L-E-N.
Okay, we'll leave that as multiple choice. Pullin or Pullins or both of the above. But Dr. Horatio Q. Birdbath is correct. And what was his role in the band? Bird calls and dog sounds?
All kinds of animal and human sound effects, which worked perfectly with Spike Jonze, both in records and on the live stage show.
This one is called Our Hour, O-U-R-H-O-U-R, as it would sound if it was actually sung by doggies.
Like gold as they stroll down the lane, each star in the sky heard him sigh this refrain. This is
our hour
for love,
our
to dream, said the curly pinkanee to his curly pinkanee. Let's be gay, he say, whoop whoop. This is
our
for love,
our
to scheme, said the little puppy he to the little puppy she. Let us sing and sing, whoop whoop. I can picture you and me forever, chasing pussy cats together.
This is
our for love,
our
to dream. We will raise a family, maybe 22 or 3. They'll be
our.
In addition to TV, Spike also did radio shows. And earlier in this show, we heard a recording from a radio show, Knighthood Goes to Pot. On one particular show, he had as a special guest, Lassie, along with Lassie's trainer. And we have this number that was sung by Eileen Gallagher, a great operatic talent. And she does this duet, allegedly, with Lassie. This is based on Il Baccio. Spike Jonze decided to call this Il Barchio, for obvious reasons.
Oh,
Going to tell you that Lassie did not really do the singing with Eileen, but I will tell you that Horatio Q. Birdbath just happened to be in the studio at that time. Before we play our closing number, courtesy of you, Spike, from the bottom of my heart, I would like to say thank you so very much for agreeing to do this show. I felt it was a long shot. You didn't know me from Adam, now you do. I hope I passed muster.
I love talking about him and reminiscing and so on and so forth, because if you think about it, he became famous like in the early 40s or whatever, and his name sustained for years and years and years, even through today. And you mentioned Spike Jones, and it puts a smile on people's face. And I just think that that's phenomenal. You have an unbelievable passion for my dad and his music and his work and how it was put together. So that's sort of what behooved me to want to do this. It wasn't just a light, you know, little, hey, I like your dad, blah, 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 can we do? No, you sent me your list of Spike Jones records that you have, and it's nuts. I mean, on and on and on.
I drive my wife crazy with them sometimes.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. I had a great time doing this, and thank you for your continued interest and passion.
You sent me something, and I thank you for this, because I didn't have this. I've seen this under various titles. I've seen it just called Carmen. I've seen it called Spike Jones Murders Carmen. And what you sent me was called Carmen at the Opera, but I think it's all the same thing.
It
one
is.
Title. Okay. This is actually a 13-minute piece. We're going to play maybe about 3 or 4 minutes of it. What can you tell me about Carmen and the portion of it that we're going to play? This is part of him murdering the classics.
Yeah, this was a 13-minute performance of Carmen at the Opera, or Spike Jones Murders Carmen, that was released as, I believe, 4 different sides in a book, so to speak. And the portion that you're going to hear is he shoots off 18 gunshots right in a row, and nothing missed. Everything hit. The band was phenomenal. Everything clicked, vocals and so on and so forth. And they just went from one thing to the next, and it's my favorite Spike Jones piece.
Spike Jones is the narrator on this piece. And as for a capsule description of what we're going to play,
the gypsy band plays, and then they go into a fortune teller piece.
The curtain goes up for Act 3. Oops, pulled it up too soon. Anyway, Carmen goes to a gypsy camp to have her fortune told.
Thank you.
gypsy band finishes playing. And all the gypsies take off their earmuffs. Carmen finds an old gypsy and asks him to tell her fortune. She wants to know who she's going to marry, Don Schmose or Escapillo.
Oh, gypsy, will you look and see what future is in store for me?
Give me your hand and keep it calm, and I will try and read your palm. Does sound odd and quite ridiculous.
Oh, yes, it's true. I'm very ticklish. I'm very, 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 very ticklish.
I see by you soon will. And you'll have. Or maybe even 4 or 5. Then you will. And he'll be. Then what will? It's really great to be alive.
Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers, Ronnie remembers.